True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Sandra Renee Cantu vanished from her Tracy, California mobile home park in March of 2009, just weeks after her 8th birthday. It was a Friday afternoon, and Sandra left home at around 4 p.m. to play at a friend's house. She was expected home for dinner, but her mother called the police and reported her missing at 7:53 p.m. Police didn't find Sandra that day, but they did locate surveillance camera footage showing the little girl skipping happily toward her home before something seems to catch her eye, and she walks off screen. Join us at the quiet end for the abduction of Sandra Cantu. The FBI became involved in the search for Sandra early on. Their behavioral analysis unit's profile for Sandra's abductor pointed to an adult male between 25 and 45 years old who knew Sandra, lived in the trailer park, and had a history with sexual assault or child pornography. But the profile was based on statistics alone. With no crime scene, investigators had to rely on Sandra's family and neighbors for clues. And there was one neighbor who caught their attention. This was a neighbor who did not fit the profile, but who would soon become the primary suspect in Sandra's disappearance.
So we're going to do a California beer. And for this beer, I picked Pale Ale by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. They're in Chico, California. Now, this is probably Sierra Nevada's flagship beer. Most everybody likes it a lot, and I do too. So it's a gold-colored beer, medium-sized white head, a little bit of lacing, good aroma, citrus, and sweet malt, which translates into a taste of grapefruit and some caramel. It's a very drinkable beer. It's only 5.6% alcohol by volume, so maybe you could have a couple at a time.
I think so. Well, we really like Sierra Nevada. Good beers.
We really like them.
Really like them. Let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, Dickie, come sit next to me. Now, this is a rough one. It is about a child. But as we normally do, we're not going to get into any kind of really graphic details.
No, we certainly are not.
No, but very sad. Just a warning that it is heartbreaking. So why don't you start us off?
Sure. So Sandra Cantu was born on March 8, 2001, the youngest of four children to parents Maria and Daniel. Her parents divorced when she was very young. So she spent most of her life living with her mother, her three older siblings, and her maternal grandparents. And they lived together in a mobile home in the Orchard Estates Mobile Home Park. That's in Tracy. This is where Sandra, the baby of the family, was loved and showered with attention. So here we have a fairly large family, I think around eight people.
Seven, I believe.
In a small mobile home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little crowded.
Yeah, but you know, they really seemed happy. And Sandra especially seemed happy. She was a very outgoing girl, had many friends. That mobile home park where they lived just had over 100 residents, and Sandra really knew most of them. She would just walk around and talk to people, not afraid to talk to new people at all.
No, very friendly little girl.
Yeah.
And that is a small park, I think, 100 residents or so.
Yeah.
So you probably would know everybody in there.
Yeah, she seemed to, and it was really normal for her to go to other trailers in the park and find friends to play with after school, because that's what she liked to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on Friday, March 27th, 2009, Sandra was excited to get home from school, and she was looking forward to spending the weekend playing with her friends. So after she got home, Sandra told her mother, Maria, that she's going to go a few trailers down to play. A new family had just moved in there, and they had some little girls, so Sandra was excited to spend time with them, new playmates. And Maria told Sandra, you know, be home for dinner, and she knew that Sandra was responsible and wouldn't leave the park. because staying in the park was a long-standing rule, and Sandra had never disobeyed that. And the other people in the park were all known to Marie, and she trusted all of her neighbors.
She did, unfortunately. So when Sandra didn't return home for dinner at 7, Maria was quite worried, and she began calling her friends' homes, but no one had seen her. As time passed, Maria felt some panic setting in. So Sandra had gone and played with those new girls, and then she hadn't been seen by anyone else. She and other family members began to search for Sandra in the neighborhood, but there was no sign of her anywhere. So they went door to door, checking where Sandra normally played, but no one had seen her since around 4. Maria's concerns continued to grow, of course, and she walked around the park shouting Sandra's name for quite a while, but couldn't find her, so it's getting close to an hour since she should have been home. It was 7:53, and Maria went back to her home and called the police. By now, she's very worried. This is an 8-year-old girl. Where is she?
Yeah, again, a small park. They probably were able to search through there pretty quickly and not see her.
Right.
And she's reasonably certain that Sandra would never leave the park on her own. So where'd she go?
Exactly.
I'd be getting pretty frantic at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's happened to most of us parents where you can't find your kid even if it's for a few minutes. And you get that horrible panic feeling.
Yeah, it doesn't take very long for that panic to set in.
No, it doesn't. And I just can't imagine people in these circumstances. It must be so hard.
So the police arrived and they searched the Cantu home and the entire mobile home park. They knocked on doors of all the homes, but no one had seen Sandra. So the first series of searches that was done, and this was the Friday night that Sandra disappeared, was what investigators call a citywide grid search. So this was done with patrol officers in their cars. They first searched all known locations or friends of the family, followed by all the locations where the missing person might be. So this is a street-by-street search, headlights on, trying to locate Sandra by her description, a photo, and a description of what she'd been wearing that day. So once they did the citywide grid search, a helicopter search was done. So the grid search was done by patrol cars within the city of Tracy and the immediate surrounding area. This was almost to the northern border of the city of Tracy.
Yes, and my understanding is that the helicopter helped the patrol cars by shining light down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was a massive search. I think it's the second biggest search in the area ever. There was some criticism that an Amber Alert did not go out, but they didn't have a car's description or a suspect's description or crime scene. So that's really something you need if you want to have an Amber Alert. They just didn't have much to say. She just seemed to have vanished.
She vanished into thin air.
Yeah. So after searching with no success throughout the night, Sandra was officially a missing person. Bloodhounds were brought in early the next morning. The dogs were from the Office of Emergency Services from Calaveras County, and they walked on some pathways where investigators believed that Sandra could have walked. But unfortunately, they weren't able to help much. The bloodhounds started out at Sandra's home, where of course the strongest scent could be found, and then they followed it out of the mobile home park through the only entrance exit. So there's only one way in and out. Then one dog went one way and the other dog went the other way, so not a good sign. They never were able to really lock in on her scent. So of course, as the search took place, the police were also looking for potential suspects who may have taken Sandra. They did a 1-mile search for sex offender registrants and found several. The FBI was brought in, as well as the California Highway Patrol, the County Sheriff's Office, and the Tracy Community Response Team and Fire Department. Also, divers were brought in to search nearby rivers, and they had ATVs to search the rural areas. But with no suspect or no vehicle description, they were really at an impasse. The FBI activated an urgent bulletin on a missing child, and the FBI's Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Unit, or CARD as they call it. Now, CARD is made up of the leading experts on child abduction, and they can mobilize anywhere in the country within 4 hours. As experts, they know that 97% of children abducted by strangers are murdered within the first 3 hours of being taken. So Sandra could have been missing for 3 hours before the police were even called. She hadn't been seen for 3 hours. But as one FBI agent put it, it was their job to concentrate on the 3% chance that Sandra was still alive.
Well,
of course.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to have hope. You can't assume the worst, although certainly worrying about the worst.
Well, yeah. You're still going to be looking, but statistically, things might not be real good.
No.
After the 3 hours or so.
Exactly. Well, police did learn that Sandra's parents had been having issues over child support and custody, and Sandra's father, Daniel, was investigated and quickly cleared of any involvement. He had actually been out of town when his daughter went missing, and besides that, the rest of the family didn't see him as the type of guy who would do that. He just wouldn't abduct his daughter. He might not have been the greatest guy, but he wasn't someone who would do that.
Okay. As police spoke with Sandra's family, they learned that her grandfather had installed a surveillance camera on the front of their house. They found footage of Sandra at 3:54 p.m., skipping toward her home. Then something seems to catch her eye or alert her in some way, and she walks off the screen. There's no footage after that showing her trying to return home. So it's pretty difficult to watch this little video.
It's heartbreaking, yeah.
Here she is skipping along, waving her arms in the air, looking happy and carefree. And
then
exits off camera, and that's it. She vanishes.
She's 8 years old. She should be happy and carefree. So it is just terrible. Her friendliness in the neighborhood kind of made everyone a suspect. She was always smiling and would strike up a conversation with pretty much anyone. And she had been allowed to roam in the park freely, and many of the neighbors had let her into their homes. And it would turn out some of the homes she went into were a little sketchy. There were some kind of weird guys living in the park who had had her over. There was actually a father-son, the son was an adult, who Sandra had visited, and they had pictures of her on their phone, which was really weird. Now, it wasn't child porn or anything, but it was definitely inappropriate.
Yeah.
So I think her friendliness was probably more of a problem than her family would realize.
Well, certainly potentially more of a problem.
Yes, exactly. So the local media arrived on the scene at around 6:30 a.m. Saturday morning. A press release had been sent out by the Tracy Police Department, but it was accidentally sent out via fax instead of email, and many of the press numbers used were out of date. So most of the national media didn't show up until Monday morning. By then, we've got a couple days of her missing behind us.
By 9 o'clock Saturday morning, the Tracy Community Emergency Response Team had arrived on the scene to help with the search for Sandra. A California Highway Patrol helicopter had been brought in to use its thermal imaging camera. And at the same time, police continued their search on the ground. They searched every car and car trunk that went in and out of the park, and dive teams continued to search the bodies of water nearby.
Well, since there really was no evidence pointing to a kidnapping or foul play specifically, it really did seem like Sandra had vanished right into thin air. By 3:30 p.m. on Saturday, a roadblock search began, which to me seems kind of late.
Yeah, you're almost 24 hours into this.
Right. Why not do the roadblock the night before? But I guess it took them a while to take it completely seriously. In the evening, maybe they thought she was just at a friend's or something. But she's only 8, so you need to take it very seriously. So anyway, they set up a roadblock canvas on Clover Road, which was just east of the trailer park entrance. And like you said, this is about 24 hours after she was last seen. They chose that time because they wanted to see people with patterns and make a note of when they came and went. Because people who might have left the park 24 hours earlier or entered the park 24 hours earlier might have been doing the same thing on Friday. So that kind of explains why they did it then. Although I'm thinking, why not just have that roadblock set up the night before and keep it set up?
Although what they could have happened then is that somebody who might be guilty of something sees the roadblock and just avoids it for the rest of the time.
Yes, but it's just that my thought is, if someone's taking her out of that park, it happened right after she was taken.
Yeah.
But either way, it really wouldn't have worked, would it?
No, it wouldn't have.
The problem was is that she was probably taken and no one knew for at least 2 or 3 hours. So investigators wanted to know what they had seen and if they had seen any suspicious people when they pulled these cars over at the park. And this could also help them determine if there was someone in the trailer park who was involved, of course. And with the park surrounded by major highways, there was always this possibility that a suspect took Sandra and left the area. So they didn't even want to think about that. But of course they had to, because it was very possible.
It certainly was. They also set up a staging area at a downtown Tracy fire station, and volunteers could go there to help, mostly by passing out flyers that were printed in both English and Spanish. The volunteers posted and distributed the flyers in Tracy and the surrounding communities. And after posting the flyers inside area malls, volunteers stood outside the entrances and passed out the flyers directly to people. So it sounds like they have a pretty efficient search going on.
There's a huge turnout, yes. It's just this horrible feeling that it's too late. Even without knowing what the outcome would be, you kind of know that you've got a late start on this. So by Monday morning, March 30th, the national media came. As I said, they were in Tracy, and now Sandra's smiling face was showed on every major TV network. On the day Sandra went missing, investigators asked her mother, Maria, if they could look at her cell phone to see if any unusual calls had come in. And of course, Maria consented. She gave investigators her phone, and she did tell them that she had received a significant number of text messages from a neighborhood mom named Melissa Huckabee that same day. And she said, this is out of the ordinary. Huckabee, a 28-year-old Sunday school teacher who lived in the mobile home park, had a daughter who was friends with Sandra. And on the day Sandra had disappeared, Huckabee sent a text to Maria, which said, tell the police that I had something stolen today around 4 p.m. I don't know if that makes a difference or not. So Huckabee claimed that a large suitcase had been stolen from her driveway at around the same time Sandra went missing. So that was odd.
I'd be really perplexed by this.
Well, I think one concern at that point before digging deeply into it was maybe someone took that suitcase to put the child in.
Sure, I could see that.
Maybe some predator took both. But I think maybe that's what Melissa Huckabee wanted people to think.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. And what other reason would you call someone you've rarely, if ever, spoken to say a big suitcase was taken from my home?
Yeah, Maria thought it was strange. She hadn't gotten a text from Huckabee ever before.
Yeah. Well, and if I was a police officer, I'd be interested in this.
Yes.
Very interested in this.
So on March 28th, that's a little over 24 hours after Sandra had gone missing, a vigil was held outside in her mobile home park. Now, Huckabee was at the vigil, and she said that as she was walking home, she looked down at the grass and saw a note lying there. So Huckabee kind of went crazy yelling and screaming and waved over the Tracy police officers and FBI agents who were there and showed them the note. So if the suitcase thing didn't make them wonder, this had to. Why is this woman inserting herself into this investigation?
Yeah, this is the second occasion.
Yes.
For this.
And what are the odds?
Well, I'd be investigating her like crazy.
I think that they started investigating her as someone who maybe knew something about what had happened.
Yeah, no, I can see that because we've got the profile of the abductor from the FBI, and she certainly doesn't fit any of those, does she?
No, but she was a suspect. But they're not thinking that she actually abducted the child at this point.
She would be a suspect who has more information about the case, most likely.
And they had to consider her, of course. Now, until she came to their attention, investigators had been looking for someone who matched the FBI's profile.
Sure, because they're the experts. They should be able to tell you what this person is like.
Absolutely. So that's a male, 25 to 45 years old, with some kind of history of sexual assault or child pornography. But Huckabee had now inserted herself into this case twice, which made her very suspicious. Something had to be going on here.
I guess there's just too much stuff by her that's out of character. I mean, maybe not out of character, just weird.
Yes, it's just not making sense.
No.
So investigators had the video surveillance of Sandra skipping down her street in front of her mobile home at 3:54 p.m., but about 10 minutes earlier at 3:43 p.m., just minutes before Sandra's image was recorded, Melissa Huckabee is seen on the park's surveillance camera. She's wearing sweatpants, a t-shirt, and house slippers. Now, at the end of the video where Sandra is seen skipping, she looks over towards the direction of Huckabee's home and walks off in that direction.
So that's some more information now that they know where Huckabee lives. Of course, they didn't see her walking into the trailer or anything. They just saw her stop skipping and head in that general direction.
Exactly.
But
so
still,
it's not solid proof of anything.
Something else, though.
But the more they look at her, yes, the more they're finding.
So at 4:02 p.m., park cameras show Huckabee's purple Kia Sportage leaving the mobile home park, turning onto Clover Road towards the church where she worked. At 5:27 p.m., a nearby Best Western Motel surveillance camera captured Huckabee driving east on Clover Road after leaving the church. She then turned to go north on Tracy Boulevard towards some irrigation ponds. And at 5:57 p.m., that same camera recorded her driving west on Clover Road back towards the church. Then at 7:10 p.m., Huckabee returned and entered the mobile home park and parked back at her home.
So as they're looking at this neighbor, the search for Sandra is continuing, and they interviewed a long list of sexual deviants and ex-cons who were out on parole, who lived in that community. But one after one, they were cleared of any involvement. One man they interviewed seemed pretty creepy. He had approached Sandra at the neighborhood pool 2 years earlier, and he had kissed her on the lips.
Ew.
Yes. So this man admitted to the kiss, but claimed that it was only some affection. It's totally inappropriate regardless. But he admitted to the police then that he had sexual fantasies involving young girls, mostly 9 to 11-year-olds. So that was a red flag.
Yes, I guess.
He still denied having anything to do with Sandra's disappearance, and he would be cleared of it. They also interviewed an unfamiliar ice cream truck driver who had been in the mobile home park on the day Sandra disappeared. Residents of the park found him to be suspicious. He wasn't usually there, and he was actually told to leave by one of the dads.
So when Melissa Huckabee approached the FBI agents and told them about the note she claimed to have found in the grass during Sandra's vigil, they were definitely suspicious of her. I'd be suspicious because I would have figured they've already looked in that area, right?
Yes, yeah.
So this is stuff that had arrived since the searching.
Well, there were several factors that we'll get to, but one of them was that it was quite windy. This was March. It was cold at night. It was windy.
So it shouldn't have stayed
probably
in
not.
That place.
It's unlikely that it would have.
Yeah. So at first, police thought that Huckabee may have been covering for someone else. And she's yelling and screaming as she sat on the ground, and she's pointing at the note.
So there was a lot of drama there.
A lot of histrionics.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, the hand-printed note read, "Cantu locked in stolen suitcase, thrown in water on Bacchetti Road and Whitehall Road. Witness." And in the note, there were two words misspelled, stolen and on. And these are pretty simple words for someone to misspell. So investigators believe that whoever had written the note had purposely misspelled a couple words and wrote sloppily. FBI handwriting expert looked at the note, and he believed it looked like someone had been camouflaging their handwriting.
Yeah, so something's going on with this Huckabee woman.
Boy, that's for sure.
So, of course, the note could be a prank or it could be real. They have to go with it and investigate it. So they began a search of the ponds at Bacchetti and Whitehall the next morning. And this was just a little over 2 miles from Sandra's home. There was a river there and a dairy farm where there were several settlement ponds for cattle manure runoff. It was really difficult to search the ponds because they were so full of animal waste. This could make you go off on a real thing on climate change, but I'm going to ignore it because right now we're talking about Sandra. But that's really gross.
Well, what's gross to me is they're talking about how the settlement ponds are so full of animal waste that you can't see clearly.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, well, what sort of bacteria are floating around in there too?
Oh, can you imagine? And those divers.
Yeah.
They are heroes if they're willing to go down in that.
Yeah, I tell you.
that better people than I am, I'm sure. So meanwhile, though, detectives followed up with more interviews of Melissa Huckabee. She'd found the note, she'd reported her suitcase missing, and she was seen driving out of the park soon after Sandra was last seen. Now, she was a friend of Sandra's family, and she was raising her 5-year-old daughter in a home she shared with her grandparents. Her daughter actually played with Sandra a lot. Her grandfather was the pastor at the church just around the corner, and she volunteered as a Sunday school teacher there. So Sandra's family had felt safe allowing Sandra at the Huckabees, which sounds reasonable. Normally, you can trust another mother.
So yeah, and she's got pretty good credentials, too.
She seemed like a really nice young woman.
Yeah.
And she has her own daughter, so why wouldn't you trust her with your daughter?
Exactly.
But now, because of all that's happened, the detectives and FBI agents are suspicious of her. Now, Huckabee's alibi was that she was at the church decorating her Sunday school classroom when Sandra was abducted. But she had been there alone. Phone records showed that she made a call from the church to the mobile home park manager around the time Sandra went missing. But, you know, it's so close by. Doesn't mean that she couldn't be responsible or involved. So agents searched Huckabee's car, and in her car, they found a blue Post-it note, and this note had 3 scribbled out words on it. With technology to isolate the writing beneath the scribbles, agents were able to read the 3 words, Bachetti, Whitehall, and water. So of course, these words were in the note that Huckabee supposedly found. So now they know she's the author of the note. They're pretty sure.
Yeah, it sure seems that she wrote it.
Oh, sure. Now, Huckabee's home was searched, and the police found a notebook that she had actually hidden below the nightstand in her bedroom. It had the same type of paper as the note, and a page was missing. And by looking into those indentations in the remaining paper, investigators were able to see letters that matched up exactly with some letters in the note. So now they can tell that she wrote the note in that notebook. So now they're absolutely certain that Melissa Huckabee had written this note herself.
Well, they're as certain as they can be.
Well, it was written in a notebook, which she had hidden in her bedroom.
Which was hidden in her bedroom.
So, yes, all fingers are pointing at her.
Sure are. Personal family videos of Sandra at Christmas were released to the public in hopes of publicizing her case. The reward for her return grew to $22,000. Search planes provided by the Coast Guard searched along with the helicopters. In the first 8 days of the search, hundreds of hours were logged, and over 10,000 flyers were distributed. Sandra's elementary school sent home letters to parents, keeping them updated, and giving advice on how to speak to their children about Sandra's disappearance.
How in the world do you? How do you tell your child this? You're really telling your child that the world is an awful place. How do you do that without breaking their spirit?
Not to be harsh, but the world is a tough place.
I know. But do you want little kids to know that? I guess they're going to find out eventually. But well, do you want to tell your 8-year-old that their friend has been murdered? It's horrible.
Yeah, well, you have to do it like piecemeal.
What do you mean?
So you don't just jump in and say she's been murdered.
Well, they don't know that yet anyway. She's missing. So tell me more about how you think you tell a child about this. That's my question.
Well, you try to tell it straightforwardly and don't embellish it or anything. Just, you know, stick to facts. Answer questions if the child hasn't. So to begin with, you'd say Sandra has disappeared. Maybe not say disappeared, because that's a tough word for 8-year-olds. Sandra's missing and we can't find her. People are looking for her, so they're trying to do that.
Yeah, well, anyway you slice it, it's horrible though.
Very difficult.
Yes. And I'd have to say none of these kids will ever look at the world the same way. It's life-changing for everyone.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. So they did bring psychologists into the school to help. And as Sandra's family prayed for her safe return, so did her classmates and the school staff. They really wanted her to be found okay. So on the morning of April 6th, the San Joaquin County Sheriff's Department dispatchers received a call that changed everything. A worker at a dairy farm on Whitehall Road had been draining an irrigation pond that morning when a suspicious item floated up to the top. And it was a black suitcase.
Well, I'm not surprised.
No, I don't think anyone was surprised, but it certainly was bad news.
I know, it's been a length of time, but they're still hoping against hope that maybe she's still alive.
Oh, sure.
And they're going to find that suitcase and realize that that's not true.
Yes. Actually, there were a couple of women that lived in nearby communities who had survived abductions when they were children. And they had come in to offer support to Sandra's family, and that really gave them hope that, yeah, she could be alive. She could get home.
Yeah. And plus, what better person to talk to than someone who's been through this?
Absolutely, yes. And these women were ready to talk to Sandra should she survive some kind of abduction and horrible circumstance.
Right. So the dairy worker, this is a 40-year-old guy named Jose Luis Franco. He was expecting to spend most of his day checking the pumps at the collection ponds on Whitehall Road. Ponds needed to be drained every 2 weeks to irrigate the fields. There were two large rectangular ponds with narrow access roads on the sides. These stood beside acres of farmland that had been recently plowed and were ready to be planted. There were also two smaller ponds. So as he drove in his truck along the access road near the first pond, while it drained, something caught Jose's eye. This was an object floating in the water. He knew it hadn't been in the pond 2 weeks ago when it was last drained, so he stopped and walked down the embankment. He was able to get close enough to see a large black suitcase, but he couldn't reach it, so he used a pitchfork from the back of his truck, and he was able to pull it over to the edge, and he tried to grab it to take it out, but it was heavy.
Yeah, so of course he had a bad feeling right from the start. This is a father, so he had heard about Sandra and of course was very worried about her, and he has this feeling now. Could this be related to the missing child?
Well, he knows about the missing child. I'm sure he knows about the missing suitcase.
So he was able to push the suitcase off to the side, and he had this bad feeling. And that feeling got worse when he saw that the case was cinched closed with a white cord around the handles. That seems really suspicious.
Yes, it certainly does.
First of all, if someone's just throwing out an old suitcase, it likely wouldn't be so heavy. And why would you bother with the white cord?
You wouldn't.
So just before 10 a.m., Jose called the county sheriff's department to report what he'd found. Unfortunately, the media heard the call go out, had helicopters in the air, before the Tracy police were even aware. Within minutes of that, TV stations began showing live footage from the air of the suitcase. But thankfully, Sandra's family wasn't watching TV at that time.
Boy, I guess.
Wouldn't that be horrible?
It would be more than horrible, Angie's. You're watching the news, see if there's anything new on your daughter's case, and you're looking at helicopters buzzing over a field where they've just found a black suitcase.
Yeah, terrible. So the Tracy police immediately sent officers to the homes of the parents, remember they were divorced, Maria Chavez and Daniel Cantu, to tell them what was going on. So the family spent the rest of the day waiting for answers and praying that their Sandra was not in that suitcase. She's the baby of the family. She's adored. Now, investigators spent the next several hours not knowing if she was in the suitcase or not, but they couldn't risk contaminating evidence if the worst was true. So in a brief press conference, police told the public that they had no indication that there was anything related to Sandra inside of the suitcase, but they explained that they needed to proceed with due diligence. The suitcase was not opened at the scene, but it was transported to the morgue in a body bag. So that makes me think they had a pretty good idea.
Oh, yeah.
That this could be the case.
I mean, anybody that knew the facts of the case that had been presented to the public would be thinking little girl's body's in the suitcase.
Well, plus the police have got the note that mentioned that area and the water. And then as they moved the bag, they could smell decomposition. So they pretty much knew at that point, although it wasn't confirmed. But once the medical examiner opened the case, everyone's worst fears were realized. Little Sandra, dressed in her Hello Kitty top and black leggings, was in this case, crammed in there in the fetal position. She was identified by her clothing and her dental records. Toxicology reports showed that she had been drugged with a benzodiazepine, alprazolam, which is the generic Xanax. There was a piece of torn cloth tied around her head, and it was soiled with blood and knotted like a noose. Sandra didn't have bruises or scratches. She did have a laceration on her inner lower lip, a little abrasion on her left elbow, and injuries to her external genitalia, meaning that she had been sexually assaulted. And it seemed that she had been assaulted with a foreign object. So the ME noted the official cause of death as homicidal asphyxiation on the autopsy report. She had been killed with a noose made of cloth, likely after being sedated with the Xanax. So some of Sandra's injuries were consistent with a rolling pin with a bent handle and a little bloody smudge that police had found inside of the church where Huckabee taught Sunday school. The pathology report revealed that that smudge on the rolling pin matched Sandra's blood. And the report also showed that she had been sexually assaulted, likely with that object. So this is horrible. And Sandra's family's notified. They're very devastated. Actually, Sandra's mother and grandmother collapsed and had to be taken to the hospital and sedated. They just could not deal with this.
Oh, I'll bet.
It's understandable.
Yeah. Horrible, horrible thing.
Very heartbreaking.
So after finding Sandra's body in Melissa Huckabee's suitcase, the police were looking even more closely at her. What she had written in the note had been the truth. So she had to be involved in order to know where Sandra could be found. Now then a retired Marine and his wife called the police to tell them that they had seen Huckabee and her vehicle at the irrigation pond on their property at Bichetti and Whitehall Road between 5:30 and 6 p.m. on March 27th, and that's the day that Sandra disappeared. They recognized her from pictures shown on TV after Sandra's abduction. They described Huckabee as being in a hurry and distracted when they saw her, and she reportedly told them, "I just had to pee real quick."
So police were continuing to review the surveillance footage, which showed Huckabee driving away several minutes after Sandra was last seen. At about the same time, Huckabee called the park manager to report that her suitcase had been stolen. 85 minutes after that, a camera outside of the church recorded her driving away from the church. And a half an hour later, she's seen returning to the church. So it was during that 30-minute time period when Huckabee was seen down at the irrigation pond.
Uh-huh.
So investigators interviewed Huckabee's family, and they learned more about her history, which of course they knew some of. They were looking at her, but they knew she was definitely a troubled person at this point. On April 4th, Huckabee was admitted into Tracy Sutter Community Hospital after she swallowed an X-Acto razor blade. Now, there are varying reports that she swallowed one, two, or three, but either way, this was seen as a suicide attempt, or at least a gesture. And while hospitalized, she watched any news on Sandra's case on TV that she could find. According to her nurses, she also repeatedly told them about her stolen suitcase. So, kind of liking the attention is where we might be going here.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, swallowing a razor blade or blades probably isn't the most effective way to kill yourself.
No, but I'd say it's one of the more dramatic
definitely,
gestures. Yes.
Definitely would be dramatic.
Yes.
If it was an attempt.
Right.
And she succeeded.
It kind of makes her look like she's done something wrong.
Yeah.
Like she's been involved.
This is what, just a few days after Sandra disappeared.
Yeah, yeah.
So suspicious looking stuff here.
Yeah, so investigators are gathering their evidence against Melissa Huckabee, and her family told them about her criminal history. So back in 2007, which was 2 years earlier, there were two mysterious arson fires at her home in Palma Alto, California. Charges were not filed against her, but she was a person of interest. Now, 3 months before Sandra went missing, she had pled guilty to petty theft charges for stealing from a Target store. Melissa Huckabee was bipolar, depressive, and she suffered from severe anxiety. She was dependent on her psychiatric medications, but she frequently had overdosed on these drugs. And her prescriptions included alprazolam, the Xanax, which was the drug found in Sandra's blood, on the toxicology reports.
So is Huckabee seeing a psychiatrist?
Well, she had been. I'm not sure if she currently was.
Okay.
It seems like she was very unstable and erratic with, you know, taking care of herself, yeah, her mental health.
And somebody wrote prescriptions for her.
Yes, yeah, she did have prescriptions. But what's more interesting is that 3 months before Sandra disappeared, another parent in the mobile home park had accused Huckabee of taking her child to a local park without her permission. So she'd taken this girl away for hours. And then Huckabee brought the little girl home, and the girl was acting very strangely. She was drowsy, she had slurred speech, and she was uncoordinated to the point of falling down. This was a 7-year-old girl. So the girl's mother and her boyfriend were very worried, and they rushed her to the hospital. Blood tests showed benzodiazepine in her blood, and Huckabee denied giving the drug to the girl, and charges were not filed. So I don't understand why charges were not filed. This to me seems like a kidnapping and a drugging of that child.
It would seem. I was going to ask you why charges were not filed, but
I wish I knew.
You don't have the answer to that either.
No. I just feel like if they had been, maybe Sandra would have been saved.
Possibly.
Now, also back on March 2nd, Huckabee allegedly drugged a 36-year-old man named Daniel Plowman, who lived about 40 miles away. And I guess he was kind of a boyfriend. It was late that night when Huckabee allegedly mixed a harmful substance with food and drink and gave it to him. And at about 1:30 a.m. the next day, middle of the night, Plowman was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence. He had pulled his car into the drive-thru of a McDonald's just 5 minutes away from Huckabee's mobile home, and he ordered some food and paid for it, and then promptly passed out behind the wheel. When he came to, he was still very disoriented and drove his car right into a wall. Police were called and they towed his car. They took him into custody, but later released him and charges were never filed.
Huh. Okay. Well, again, this did happen in the middle of the night. Nobody got hurt.
Well, I suppose, but he had said he hadn't taken any drugs and he didn't have a high alcohol level.
Yeah. So when Huckabee was released from the hospital after her X-Acto knife ingestion, she returned to an empty home. Her grandparents and her daughter had left town. Police tapped her phone, and the very next day, they listened to a phone call that was pretty shocking and very concerning. She called Maria's home and asked if Sandra's sister would like to come down and play with her daughter. So
yikes.
This is going to set off all sorts of alarms, right?
Well, yeah. Who knows what this lady's up to?
Yeah. The police seem to be fairly convinced that she's the perpetrator.
That she killed Sandra, yes.
Right. So they're busy getting more information to be able to charge her. And then to hear Huckabee say to Sandra's sister, "Why don't you come down and play with my daughter?" Ooh.
It gives you chills, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, of course, they're worried. Is Huckabee now planning to kill Sandra's sister?
Mm-hmm.
Sandra's mother, though, was not aware that Huckabee was a suspect in Sandra's death. So she was about to send Sandra's older sister over to Huckabee's house. But to prevent harm coming from another child, police decided they had to move in and arrest her right away. So she was taken into custody and taken immediately into an interrogation room. She was confronted at this time with the evidence police had against her. After hours of talking, Huckabee confessed to killing Sandra, but Huckabee claimed that Sandra's death was just a terrible accident. So she claimed that Sandra was playing hide and seek and was in the suitcase, but that she, Huckabee, got distracted and forgot about Sandra being there. So she's trying to suggest that Sandra hid in the suitcase and suffocated. This seems impossible.
Well, if not impossible, highly improbable.
Well, and if you look at the autopsy report, it doesn't match.
No.
So she also claimed to have tried CPR, but it didn't work, so she decided to hide the body. Now, an innocent person, if a child dies in your custody, you're going to call 911. You're not going to say, "Oh, I need to hide the body." That's not what a normal person does.
No.
Huckabee denied sexually assaulting Sandra, but of course she was held and charged. A partially missing cord from a set of blinds in the church where Huckabee worked matched the cord used to tie the handles of the suitcase. So there's another piece of evidence against her. But Sandra's family members were shocked to learn who was responsible for Sandra's abduction and murder. Maria felt very betrayed because they had trusted Huckabee. Then an examination of Huckabee's computer was really shocking because this revealed that Sandra's abduction was premeditated. Now, even I didn't really think that right away. I thought maybe she lost her temper with the girl, that she was just kind of a sick person. But this is really sick if this was a premeditated act.
It sure seems to be.
Yes. As we go through it, we'll see that it kind of had to be.
Yeah. So Huckabee had been making plans for the crime March 25th, 2009.
Yeah, so that's 2 days before Sandra went missing.
Right. So after a spontaneous sexual encounter with Daniel Plowman at a nearby motel, Melissa returned home, sat at her computer, and began searching maps in and around San Joaquin County, trying to find bodies of water. So this spontaneous sexual encounter just happened.
Well, apparently they were having some hookups.
And this was one.
That's probably not why no charges were filed against her, because he still wanted to have sex with her. Well, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
People are people.
So after looking for bodies of water in her county, Huckabee then carefully reviewed California's Megan's Law website. This law gives the names and addresses of almost 63,000 registered sex offenders in the state of California. So she's looking for someone that lives nearby and she can pin it on him?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When she spoke to police early on, she did mention several men in the area as possible suspects.
Yeah.
So that was definitely her plan. And it might have worked if she had not done the note thing and the texting. They might have never even looked at her. She really just kind of got herself caught.
Well, she messed up. I wouldn't say a perfect crime, but it would have been difficult.
Yeah, nobody would have considered that she would do that, especially with the sexual assault aspect.
Yeah.
But this wasn't Huckabee's first time doing this sort of research either. Back on September 11th, 2008, she had apparently found an article on CNN.com that had interested her. And the story was about a missing 4-year-old French-Israeli girl named Rose Pisum. And Rose had been missing for 2 weeks when Israeli law enforcement found her stuffed into a suitcase at the bottom of a river. Her own grandfather was charged in her murder, but the article went on to discuss how advanced the decomposition was and how difficult it was for investigators to do any lab tests on the body. So if you put this together with her drugging the child, it makes sense.
On March 26, 2009, the day before she abducted Sandra, Huckabee searched WebMD and asked about what the physical effects would be on a person who ingested razor blades. It's good to do your homework, your due diligence here.
Well, the interesting thing about that is it's before Sandra was taken, and she's looking into the razor blade thing already. So was that premeditated as well?
Sure.
Seems to be.
Then on March 27th, after getting home from school, Sandra told her mom that she was home and she had some macaroni and cheese. Then she asked if she could go out and play. About 3 p.m., Sandra walked out the door towards Huckabee's home. She rang the doorbell and Huckabee answered. Her daughter Madison sat nearby eating a hot dog. Sandra asked if she could play with Madison. Huckabee told her, "Well, Madison can't play right now." Huckabee then closed the door and went back into the living room. She was sitting in the middle of the living room floor getting some Sunday school literature together.
And we know this basically from the grandparents who were home at that point.
Yes. Now, her grandfather, Lane Lawless, wasn't feeling well that day, but he remembered Huckabee loading the car. He told police that a few days earlier, she had asked him to get her suitcase out of his storage shed beside the home.
So after that, Sandra had walked to Lot 9. That's a home where residents had just moved in with two little girls. And for the next 45 minutes or so, Sandra played on the outdoor swing with one of the girls before they began drawing pictures and watched movies. At 3:12 p.m., Huckabee sent Maria a text message asking if Miranda, that's Sandra's older sister, could come over and watch her daughter Madison. Huckabee didn't like Sandra playing at their home because when Sandra played with Madison, they would sometimes get into things they weren't supposed to and make a mess, and this made Huckabee very angry. Actually, before Sandra's abduction, Huckabee had forbidden Sandra from playing with Madison anymore. She'd accused Sandra of stealing one of Madison's toys, but Huckabee's grandmother claimed this was only a minor incident and that Sandra had returned the toy right away.
Now, playing with the new girl at Lot 9, Sandra said she would have to leave because she needed to go home and do her homework. Checking in was a strict rule. So that's where we get to 3:54 p.m., where Sandra is seen on that surveillance video skipping towards her home, and then suddenly she's veering off in the direction of Huckabee's trailer. Apparently called over by Melissa Huckabee, Sandra happily skipped towards the home, assuming that Madison was able to play now. Now, detectives believe that Huckabee lured Sandra into her car. Huckabee knew that Sandra's grandfather had installed surveillance cameras, so she took a different route out of the mobile home park to avoid being seen on them.
So Huckabee likely got Sandra to go into her car by asking her to help her decorate her Sunday school room, something like that. Because Sandra was always happy to help people. She'd helped people with cooking and gardening. Just a super friendly girl, which makes this all the more tragic.
Now, after she arrived at the Clover Road Baptist Church, which was less than a mile away, Melissa Huckabee tortured and murdered Sandra. Between 4:02 p.m. and 5:37 p.m., Huckabee drugged, beat, and sexually assaulted Sandra with a rolling pin before strangling her and suffocating her with a rag. Then after redressing her, Huckabee put her body inside the suitcase. Then after securing the suitcase with a broken cord from a nearby window blind, Huckabee left the church at 5:37 p.m. and drove to the irrigation ponds at Bocchetti and Whitehall Roads.
So after dumping the suitcase into the pond, Huckabee was seen by witnesses Jeremy Chappelle and his wife Elena, who had decided to take their 5-year-old son to dinner at a nearby Olive Garden. The Chappelles had lived on Whitehall Road for over 4 years. As they were driving, they noticed a vehicle parked by a pond. The road is public, but once you leave the pavement, you're on their private property. There was nobody in the vehicle, so Jeremy got out to see where the person was. This is normally what he would do when people were on his property. And that's when he saw Huckabee, and he asked her what she was doing there. She said she had to use the restroom and couldn't make it into town, is what he said. And he said, "All right, since you're done, why don't you leave?" But Jeremy noticed a bumper sticker on the back of the woman's SUV, and it read, "My brother's a U.S. Marine," along with a yellow "Support Our Troops" ribbon. So Jeremy, a former Marine, commented to her that he had been in the Marines, and then he watched her pull away and drive back towards Tracy and didn't think anything of it until reports came out about Sandra. So, Huckabee's indicted, and after 2 weeks of hearing testimony and seeing evidence, the San Joaquin County Grand Jury indicted her on murder with special circumstances and sexual penetration, kidnapping, lewd and lascivious acts, and rape by an instrument in Sandra's case. And she was also indicted for drugging and kidnapping the 7-year-old girl back in January and for drugging Daniel Plowman in early March. And the district attorney decided to seek the death penalty for Sandra's murder. So the official death penalty trial for Melissa Huckabee was set for October 18, 2010. That would be just 18 months after Sandra Cantu's murder. But Melissa Huckabee walked into the courtroom on May 10, 2010 and pled guilty to the murder of Sandra Cantu. A plea deal presented by the prosecution with the agreement of the Cantu family was offered to Melissa. Life without the possibility of parole, and the death penalty would be dropped. The DA also agreed to dismiss the charges of rape and furnishing a harmful substance. So it was a plea deal Huckabee had to take if she wanted to avoid California's death row, because it was fairly certain that she would be convicted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a strong case.
Very. Now, at her sentencing, Sandra's family members were able to give their victim impact statements. The loss of Sandra had devastated the family, but they were relieved about the plea deal and didn't want to endure a trial. Now, when it was her turn to speak, Huckabee said, "I still cannot understand why I did what I did. This is a question I will struggle with for the rest of my life.
So Huckabee had not provided any answers. When she was led away, a note written by her was given to Sandra's mother. And after some really just kind of generic apologies, Huckabee ended the note by telling Maria that she had cell phone photos of Madison and Sandra trick-or-treating and just wanted to let her know if she wanted them. And this was followed by, "I will never talk about this again." So what a bitch. What an awful person.
That's horrible.
That's so shitty. To Maria, this note showed Huckabee's lack of remorse for her horrible crimes, and I'd have to agree with that. That's a very casual way to be referring to such a horrible thing.
Isn't it? So Melissa Huckabee was described by many as a statistical anomaly. Searching through violent crime databases, the FBI could not find similar crimes. Women are responsible for less than 7% of all murders, and they do commit sex offenses, but the murder and sex offense by a non-family member who acted alone without a male counterpart is extraordinarily rare. A review of the data from the 2007 Uniform Crime Report confirmed that the arrest of Melissa Huckabee in the Sandra Cantu investigation was, and I quote, "a first," unquote. The FBI could not find any other cases where a woman acted alone.
Yeah, the profile by the FBI had investigators looking for a white male in their 30s or 40s, basically. But fortunately, the Tracy police did keep their options open when it came to finding Sandra's murderer. But if Melissa Huckabee hadn't injected herself into this investigation, I think it would have been much more difficult for the police to even see her as a potential suspect.
No question.
Now, Huckabee never gave the police her motive for what she did to Sandra, but those involved in the investigation do have theories. Deputy D.A. Thomas Testa believed that Huckabee suffers from Munchausen syndrome, also known as factitious disorder or hospital addiction syndrome. Munchausen suffers feigned disease, illness, or psychological trauma in order to get attention or sympathy for themselves, and usually this is from the medical community. Munchausen sufferers can become pretty knowledgeable about medicine and are often able to produce symptoms that can result in lengthy, costly medical testing, some long hospital stays, and even unnecessary surgeries. So this makes sense when looking back at Huckabee's history of lengthy hospital stays and her very frequent WebMD searches. And in fact, much of her financial debt, which was considerable, was due to hospitalizations. Daniel Plowman, the man she drugged, even testified to her knowledge of the effects of swallowing razor blades, because she had said to him it could possibly get lodged inside and cause internal bleeding, and if it got lodged in your colon, it could possibly shred you open. And these were things she had read on WebMD, apparently.
Psychiatrist Mark Feldman, who is an expert in Munchausen syndrome, has said that Huckabee may have been misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. He hasn't treated her, but he sees her diagnosis more as a borderline personality disorder. According to Feldman, BPD is mostly evident in young adults who display poor coping mechanisms and usually exhibit some form of Munchausen syndrome, though the two go hand in hand. Living at her grandparents' with her young child, Huckabee had no other friends. Most of her grandparents' attention went to Madison, and she tried to get social acceptance on sites like Facebook, where she claimed she was childless. During her hospital stays, she always liked to be on a first-name basis with the nurses who cared for her, and she clearly enjoyed the attention that she was being shown.
Well, additionally, in Huckabee's past relationships, she consistently would cry rape and domestic abuse. So this shows that psychological trauma and playing the victim brought her the attention she wanted. If she was suffering from Munchausen syndrome, she also likely was suffering from Munchausen by proxy. According to Dr. Feldman, if a person has Munchausen syndrome, he or she is more likely than the average caregiver to have Munchausen by proxy. Munchausen by proxy is similar to Munchausen, except it's the child or someone else close to the sufferer who's often ill or experiences these abuses. And Huckabee's daughter, Madison, often missed school and was taken to frequent doctor visits. Also with the drugging of the 7-year-old neighbor and Daniel Plowman, Huckabee was putting herself into the middle of a situation that brought her more attention.
Also, according to Dr. Feldman, the fabrication or the induction of an illness is an expression of jealousy, rage, or the desire to control others. Huckabee created an environment around her that was similar to this, and whoever crossed her or took away her control suffered consequences. For example, ex-boyfriend Joshua Palmer wanted to get away from Melissa, which made her angry. So she filed a restraining order, playing the victim, and punished him. She did this in other relationships with men as well, including with Madison's father.
So we're getting a picture here of a very troubled woman.
Yes, we are.
According to Dr. Feldman, most female Munchausen patients have a history of filing false rape reports, restraining orders, and claims of abuse. The suspected arson in her history fits into this as well because of the excitement and attention this would bring her. After the drugging incident of the 7-year-old girl and after Sandra disappeared, Huckabee made similar statements about each of these incidents. She actually said in both of these cases, "If their parents would have watched them better, this would never have happened. I would never let my daughter wander around alone." So it's possible that Huckabee was trying to punish these mothers? These statements show that she was drawing attention to herself, trying to portray herself as a better mother. And then being the one finding the note during the search for Sandra was probably the most excitement she'd had in a long time. Because not only then was she surrounded by those closest to the investigation, but she felt important. And she began voluntarily speaking with investigators and giving them her ideas of who may have taken Sandra.
Yeah, now, all this does not explain the sexual assault.
I think that's the biggest mystery.
And we don't know. I mean, Huckabee hasn't said anything.
No, she's never admitted to it.
Her reason for sexually assaulting Sandra could be that she had an attraction to young girls. And there's also some possibility that Huckabee tried to get Daniel Plowman set up to take the blame for Sandra's murder. It was clear that Huckabee didn't like Sandra. And if she set up Plowman for Sandra's murder, she could destroy both of them in one attempt. And by drugging Plowman in March, there were police records proving he had been found with benzodiazepines in his blood.
So yeah, I think that's possible that she gave him that drug so that when she gave the drug to Sandra, it would look like maybe he drugged her and sexually assaulted her.
Yeah.
And in that case, I think the sexual assault was just to mislead investigators towards a man. Now, it doesn't make 100% sense, but I don't think she was that smart about it. So I don't think all of it does make sense.
No, that's a perfect statement. She's not that smart.
No. Most everyone involved in the case, though, does agree that Huckabee hated Sandra Cantu. And there has to be something wrong with a grown woman who would hate an 8-year-old. Sandra would show up several times a day to play with Madison, and that annoyed Huckabee. Sandra was popular, outgoing, and friendly, and this was the opposite of Huckabee's daughter, Madison, who, you know, had a weird life with her mother.
Yeah.
So Sandra would show up at Huckabee's wearing new clothes, and Madison would see them, and she'd know she couldn't have them. Because Huckabee was unemployed. She was a Sunday school teacher, but that was just volunteering at her grandfather's church. So, maybe Sandra having new clothes and more fun made Huckabee look bad, and maybe she felt jealousy and anger towards Sandra, even though we know that Sandra was just an innocent child. So, I do believe she hated Sandra. I think that people are right about that. And to me, the most likely reason for the sexual abuse was to just get police looking at a man. It's possible that she was attracted to children and that she did that for her own pleasure, whatever you want to call it. It's disgusting. But I don't think so. I think this whole plot was to make it look like it was a man and get rid of Sandra and get lots of attention.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most likely thing. But I'd love to hear from our listeners what they think.
No, it's looking like she's going to set up her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend.
It kind of looks that way, although it's not only him. She did point to other men in the mobile home park as possible perpetrators.
Right.
And some of them were creepy. So it may have worked if she had not made the mistakes that she made.
Well, and they were significant mistakes.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just a disaster, a horrible crime, and heartbreaking for everyone involved.
Well, she's where she won't do that again, at least not to a kid.
That's true. That's where she belongs. So TCB's music was produced by Mike McClellan, and you can learn more about his music by going to podcastps.com. Before we move on to feedback, I'd just like to take a moment to tell our listeners about True Crime Brewery Premium. If you'd like to support our show and get episodes ad-free, subscribing to TCB for ad-free and premium episodes might be just the thing. Now, our last premium episode was on Tina Fails, and I thought that was really an interesting case that we discussed. It was a cold case, so I think that's worth listening to right there. And once you subscribe, you get our regular episodes ad-free, plus that special members-only episode each month, and a gift of coasters, a bottle opener, or our classic TCB snifter, so you can drink your beer along with us as you listen. Just go to tygrabber.com and look at our subscribing options. Now there are like 160-some shows in that members-only feed, so lots to listen to, lots to binge. You can also subscribe for the same benefits through Patreon, and you can do that by going to patreon.com/tygrabber. Either way, you'll get your own personal subscription link that you can paste into your podcast app, so you can listen there or on our website without any commercials or promos like this one. So it might be something you'd like to do. One more thing, if you have comments, a case suggestion, or a great beer to tell us about, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com, or even better, leave us a voicemail. There's a direct link in our show notes for you to click on and record your voicemail, which may be played on a future show. And for the remainder of the month, anyone who has their voicemail read on our show is going to get their own free bottle opener. So if we play your voicemail, please send us an email with your address so we can get that out to you.
Yeah, because these are really cool bottle openers.
I love them. I've got one in my wallet.
It's time for listener feedback.
So what have we got for feedback today?
I got a couple voicemails. The first one is from Dee, and she has a beer suggestion.
Oh, that's a little different. Let's hear it.
Hey, y'all. This is Dee Milton from Rowlett, Texas. I want to let you know, first and foremost, I feel super lucky finding this podcast. I'm a subscriber. I have a beautiful beer snifter, and I appreciate the lovely handwritten note. Thank you, Jill and Dick. I wanted to give you guys a beer suggestion versus a show suggestion, if that's okay. This beer suggestion is from Avery Brewing Company out of Boulder, Colorado, where many horrible things have happened. And the beer that I want to give you a suggestion for is called Maharaja IPA. It's a 10% ABV Imperial India Pale Ale. It is super easy to drink, but it will get you. It's super potent. I hope you guys enjoy the suggestion. I hope you guys take my suggestion, but most of all, I hope you guys keep on keeping on. I really enjoy it. Take care.
Well, thank you, Dee.
That was very nice. And I did want to play it because we don't get a lot of beer suggestions. Now this one, Avery Brewing, good place.
Yeah, we've been there. Well, I do love Boulder, Colorado, actually. Yeah. And I didn't know there were a lot of horrible things that happened there. So I'll have to do my research on crimes there.
Yeah, so Maharaja, they'll kick your butt. But there's another one made by Avery called Tweak, T-W-E-A-K. It's a imperial stout. It's like 16-17% alcohol by volume.
Whoa.
And that'll really kick your ass.
I don't think I've ever had one that strong. I think 10-11% is probably the limit.
You've had sips.
Have I?
Yes.
Okay.
I just don't tell you.
Oh, okay. I get it.
See?
Yeah.
That's how it works.
You're sneaky.
But yeah, thank you, Dee. We love the beers from Avery.
Okay, so we will work on doing a case from there and having that beer, because now I want one.
Okay.
So our next voicemail is from Claire.
Yes, and Claire has a case suggestion for us.
Hi, Dick and Jill. This is Claire from Kansas City. I have called you guys before and left a voicemail, which did get played on the podcast, which was super exciting. But I'm calling again to try and redeem myself. I had called to suggest the case in... north of Kansas City a little bit. It happened in Platte City of Quentin Odell, who I actually did go to high school with. And back in the early 20-teens, he murdered a young woman who he was working with and then attempted to murder another woman and was caught. It's a very interesting case. And there was an episode of On the Case with Paula Zahn about it. And I still recommend that case, and I'm hoping that I can persuade you guys to do that case with this new voicemail. But I'm redeeming myself because when I left my first voicemail, I got flustered and said something about how I'm not really a beer drinker, but Boulevard is great, which it is, you know, and that's a Kansas City brewery. But I wanted to call back and recommend a brewery that I do like that is a little bit smaller and more local that I think you guys will love. And that's called Cinderblock Brewery in North Kansas City, just north of downtown. And there's a lot of other breweries in that area as well. But I love Cinderblock. They have a wide variety of beers. I really like sours and ciders and things like that. They have a couple of delicious ciders that I love. And they have great seasonal beers that they release and stuff like that. So I'm hoping that calling back with a more specific recommendation of a beer that you may not have had before might persuade you to do that case. So give them a look. And I'm loving the podcast. All of the recent episodes have gotten me back into my weekly listening habit, and I love it. You guys do an awesome job. So thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Claire. So that does ring a bell with me. I think I remember that voicemail. I'm not sure why we didn't do it. You know, to be honest, I think sometimes we lose them. Although now I've got Dick putting them in a file in the computer. So now we do keep all of our case suggestions. But I think maybe we just kind of lost track of that one.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Because the case she's describing with Quentin Odell, this is very interesting.
It is. It really is. And I remember it. But, you know, my brain's not what it used to be. So it probably just left my brain for a while.
You are getting older.
I am. So we'll keep an eye on that and try and do that for you, especially since you've tried twice. I have to like your persistence here.
Well, in this one, the reason I thought it would be very interesting, apparently this guy had no previous record or history, and he's an Eagle Scout for what that's worth. But in April of 2011, he came upon a woman who was fishing, and they talked for a while, and he left, or she was getting ready to leave, and he picked up a little hatchet and killed her.
Just right out of the blue.
Right out of the blue.
It is weird, yeah.
And then a few months later, in 2011... is sitting there watching some game on TV with a drinking companion. He called this woman up and said, hey, you want to hang out? And he showed up with a six-pack and a bottle of tequila. Good combination. But anyway, he suddenly took out a razor and disemboweled her. He opened her up from her sternum down to her pelvic area.
Oh, God.
Somehow she survived.
Oh, well, good for her. Jesus.
And was able to identify him. And he pleaded guilty to this crime of assault. And he also confessed to the killing of the woman who had been fishing.
It had to be more than assault, didn't it? Maybe it was attempted murder?
Attempted murder, sure.
Assault would seem a little benign for what you're saying he did.
And he did it so that he wouldn't face the death penalty.
Sure. That seems to happen a lot. And in a lot of cases, they're never going to actually get the death penalty anyway.
No. So he's in prison, life without parole. So there shouldn't be anything going on with him.
Okay, so Quentin Odell. Noted. So we're just going to read the one email from Julie, which has two cases. And Julie writes, I love your podcast and enjoy your soothing voices combined with the ways you play off one another with such comfortable ease. Well, thank you, Julie, very, very much. Wondering if you might be interested in a few crime cases that have fascinated me, if you haven't already covered them. Thanks for your consideration. Warmest wishes, Julie.
Right, and then the first case is a guy named Ernest Shearer III. He was a professional poker player who was accused and tried and convicted of murdering his parents with a baseball bat because he was in debt from gambling and asked his father for a loan, and his father refused, and he got pissed off because he's entitled to this money.
Sure.
He thinks.
Right.
So he kills both his parents.
Wow. So there's a Dateline, the Country Club murders. Another case that fascinates me, Julie writes, is about Dr. Mark Wrangler, anesthesiologist accused and convicted of gassing his wife to death with carbon monoxide. This is another Dateline House of Secrets, and I'm kind of shocked that I'm not familiar with that. I thought I'd seen all the Datelines, but there are a lot of them.
There are a lot of them.
So this guy, Ernie, killed his parents in 2008, was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder, and sentenced to life without parole. And then Dr. Wrangler called 911 in September of 2006 to report the carbon monoxide monitor had alarmed and his wife was unconscious. When authorities arrived, they found her dead. So her death was believed a homicide, and this was mainly a circumstantial case. So I think that's a really interesting one, too. I think we've got 3 great case suggestions and a couple good beer suggestions, too.
There you are.
So thank you very much, D, Claire, and Julie C. We really appreciate you writing in and calling in.
Yeah, you got some interesting stuff for us. So thank you very much.
They really do. I think a lot of our cases now come from suggestions by listeners, which I think is great.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, so much for listening and for your contributions. And we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.